So, the topic of dukkha. Dukkha is often translated into English as suffering, and it is might not be the best translation. And I'll talk about a little bit the meaning or the meanings of this word. One of the reasons why I'm a little bit hesitant today to use the word suffering is that some English speakers, when they hear the word suffering, they think of the big suffering. Suffering's like a big deal. It's a major catastrophes, death, major illnesses, major challenges. That's what suffering is. And for some people, they don't occur that often. And so what's the relationship to daily life and all our activity? And so suffering might not be the best translation. And sometimes it sounds a little bit like the in Pali as the opposite is sukha. Du is usually a prefix meaning bad, wrong, or some off, and su is good or happy or something. And the cultivation of sukha, of well-being, is the foundation for being able to really penetrate or see or have liberating insight into dukkha. And so this morning we talked about, I tried to talk a little bit about this foundation of this is what we cultivate. We cultivate well-being, cultivate happiness. And for some people, it seems like a strange idea that you could actually cultivate and develop happiness. One of the things I emphasized is that you can also just simply begin by looking more widely into the present moment. For what is good, for what is pleasant, enjoyable, maybe even inspiring. And that many times people have selective bias, that they orient around what's difficult. They orient around where the suffering is, the distresses, the difficulties are, around what's wrong. And that often there's plenty of stuff that is right. And so some degree of happiness can come just appreciating what's already here, being content with what one has. But it's also possible to cultivate happiness in the way that the Buddhist tradition emphasizes. It begins with cultivating an ethical life. And there's something about living an ethical life, at least for the Buddha. He thought that if you did that, you'd have a certain kind of happiness that in English is usually translated as the bliss of blamelessness. That at least in that part of your life, you can be happy that you didn't kill anybody today. You can be happy you didn't steal from anyone today. Happy you didn't hurt anyone with your sexuality today. Happy you didn't lie intentionally today. And happy that you didn't get intoxicated. And this idea that that you'd be happy you didn't do these things, most of us, I think, who's listening to this, probably it didn't occur to you today that, you don't go around killing people regularly or probably at all. And so to be happy that you don't do something that's not part of your life doesn't really seem like that should be a source of happiness. When you read the newspaper and read what goes on around the world, that you are in fact someone who's safe for others in this dramatic way of not killing, not stealing, not hurting people, this is a gift. And for the Buddha, it's okay, it's appropriate to feel happy that in these gross kind of ethical transgressions, you're not one of those people. The kind of things that we're often criticize ourselves for and berate ourselves for many of us in this modern world, is not for these gross ethical lapses, but often for smaller things, feelings of inadequate or feeling unworthiness or something. But it's possible to improve one's ethics and live a more ethical life, a life that causes less and less harm in the world. And that is said to be a source of happiness and contentment. It's possible to learn how to be content with what one has, if what one has is the basic needs for how to live and live a life. And so not to feel like you have to always have the latest and the greatest of something and have as much as someone else. But to have a certain kind of profound contentment and ease with what one has and to use it and not feel like we need to do something else that can be cultivated. There's a variety of kinds of happinesses that can be cultivated, and one of them is the cultivation of compassion. When compassion is at its most natural, when compassion is occurs without a lot of extra baggage, extra difficulties, just the compassion by itself, compassion in the presence of suffering has a certain feeling of satisfaction or ease. Dalai Lama talks about if you want to be happy, have compassion for others, care for others. And so the cultivation of compassion, opening the heart in some way, is a source of happiness, caring for others, being as concerned with the welfare of others as you are in your own welfare, can be a source of happiness. And so it's possible to cultivate this and create a foundation. And for the purposes of being on the path to liberation, one of the purposes of doing so is so that we can have insight into dukkha. Now, the word dukkha in Pali, the literal meaning of it is pain, painful. It's really an adjective, and so it means painful. And so what's often said in English, you know, the First Noble Truth, that birth is suffering, old age is suffering, death is suffering, sickness is suffering, being separated from what you love is suffering, being with what you don't like is suffering. The more literal translation of it is, birth is painful, old age is painful, death is painful, sickness is painful. And you get a very different feeling if you use the adjective painful than if you use the word suffering in relationship to all these things. Many people, it's more understandable. Yes, of course. Birth is painful, and death is painful often, and sickness is painful. But then it's easier to understand that it's not the whole picture. It's not a categorical kind of judgment about how bad these things are. It just means, yeah, it's painful, and it's also other things. Birth can be inspiring and source of great happiness, and suffering, sickness is not only painful, it can be other things as well. And some of them are kind of nice. So the literal meaning of the word dukkha is painful, and it's a little bit used in the Buddha's teaching as a metaphor. The idea of pain is then used to represent other forms of challenges that we have. And we have that little bit in English. If you say that, today for Gil Fronsdal, technology was painful. technology, always say it was a pain today because there was all these buttons to push. And I'm not going to say it's suffering, but to say it was a pain just means that it was in irritation or it was just a challenge or something. And it doesn't elevate it to the heavy idea that, you know, that I'm suffering because of all this. It was just perhaps a minor irritant. Not really. I just hope it was not for you all. And so the idea that there's pain in this world, and different things are painful. And the task of practice is to have insight into it, but the kinds of insight and understandings we can have as we investigate what metaphorically is painful for us, what's difficult, distressing, challenging, maybe that brings suffering to us. There's a lot of different things to learn and discover. And in fact, the way that English translators translate the word dukkha into English has a lot to do with their philosophy of life, their philosophy of what they think Buddhism is about or the central purpose of what practice is. English translations are not philosophically neutral, dharmically neutral. There's different dharma teachings almost that comes depending on the translation you use. So one of them is suffering, the very common. Another one is one translator uses is stress. and other translators are unsatisfactory or unreliable. And in fact, the three wonderful and significant translators of our Pali text into English in our scene, Tanissara Bhikkhu, Bhikkhu Bodhi, and Analyo, they each have different translations they use or different ways of explaining, understanding this word dukkha. And I think each of them has a little different angle or understanding, a different philosophy or different approach that they take. I say this so you don't take Buddhist teachings as being definitive and categorical so much around this topic of dukkha, because it's important not to do that, because it's painful to do that for sure, but also the idea is to be have the freedom or the flexibility to begin looking at your own experience and not to look at your own experience through the lens that it has to fit into the lens of some presentation of what Buddhism is. And so mindfulness is a very important part of this, because mindfulness, it puts us in the middle of our own experience. It begins to shine a light of awareness, of knowing, of understanding, of what's actually happening here. And rather than trying to shoehorn ourselves into being, having the Buddhist experience, if anything, we're trying to wake up and realize, what is this experience? And how does the reference of Buddhist teachings help me understand it, my own experience? So that Buddhism is more like a spotlight that helps us to see the reference point than it is something we're supposed to kind of be in, or align ourselves to, or supposed to explain everything who we are. So we practice mindfulness to see what's here. And what we see is a little different if we can see with a foundation of confidence, a foundation of certain kinds of contentment, certain kind of ease, well-being, happiness. And that tends to create a different lens than if what we, if the lens we're using is distress, irritation, anger, frustration, discouragement, you know, and seeing everything that's wrong about ourselves or the world around us. And the chances are, with some modicum of well-being, some settled sense of ease, that hopefully we're seeing more objectively. We're seeing with less filters and across the lens, and we can just see, well, that's what's going on. That's what's going on more clearly. And if what's going on is painful, to learn to see that and come to terms with that. If what we're seeing is easeful or happy, to learn to see that and to recognize that for what it is. And in the process of this, something very interesting begins to happen, is that the ability to be stable, confident, metaphorically upright, and be able to see, look at what's painful, what's difficult, what's challenging, what's suffering, to be able to look at what's pleasant, enjoyable, happy, joyful, how we are able to look at it becomes more and more important. It's almost as if there's a certain freedom to be found in how we gaze. Be still and gaze upon everything kindly. Be still and gaze upon everything with freedom, with ease. Now this is, I think, for many people, a very different approach than solving our problems or accumulating more pleasure, accumulating more happiness, holding on to things, or trying to push things away. As if the problem is only the problem, life is only measured, understood by our relation, how things relate to us. Our suffering is completely a product of the people who come in to do things to us, or the events and how they affect us. And so we have to fix the events of the world. Or happiness is only because we've won the lottery, or things in the world are just right, so we can become happy. And so when it's always out there, in a certain kind of way that we're trying to become happy or trying to avoid suffering, we're a little bit then at the mercy of what happens in the world around us. And in the language of ancient Buddhism is that we're victims of the winds of the world, meaning when the weather changes, we just kind of got pushed around by the winds in new ways. The way, one of the things that we're doing in Dharma practice, to cultivating, we're actually cultivating a stronger and stronger mind. We're just cultivating a strength, inner strength, even a kind of power to be able to be present in a confident way, in an engaged way, in a mindful way, in a focused way, and in a way that allows for there to be wisdom. Each of the five faculties becomes strong as we do this practice. And as we have developed some strength, then we can kind of hold our own in the face of the winds of the world, or hold our own even in the face of the winds of our own mind. Today I read in the suttas a little saying that goes something like this, that a practitioner has mastered, practitioners master their mind, or say, I think it works a little bit better this way in English, practitioners control their own minds. They're not controlled by their mind. There is a way of becoming stable and strong and confident that no matter what the thoughts and feelings and motivations we have, some wisdom, some place of stability exists where we can see it, we can respect it, but we don't have to give in to it. We don't have to pick it up. We don't have to react to it. So as practice gets stronger, our ability to see clearly what's happening becomes stronger and stronger. And at some point, there's a shift where our ability to observe or to see or to be aware or to be present with experience becomes kind of like its own thing that is felt to be independent from the circumstances we're in. And we're not yoked or tied or defined by the circumstances anymore because of the strength of this kind of mindfulness. And what's important about this is it's possible to have dukkha, things be painful, things be a pain, and not need to do anything about it, because where we live is we live in the freedom of awareness, freedom of being able to observe, freedom of awareness that is not pushed around by or constricted by the circumstances we're in. And so it's not necessarily we need to fix our suffering, get rid of our suffering, solve our suffering. Doing that is wise sometimes, to be involved in that, but it's not the only thing that we can do. And as meditation, vipassana practice, mindfulness practice goes deeper and deeper, so it gets stronger and stronger, as this ability to be mindful becomes stronger, it actually becomes less and less important, especially in the context of meditation, to solve our suffering, to solve the things that are difficult and painful. It becomes more and more important to see it clearly, see it more and more clearly. And that ability then to, as I keep saying, to see clearly without having to solve or fix or dissolve our suffering is supported by having developed confidence in the practice, confidence in ourselves, confidence in mindfulness, that we have an ability to, it's worthwhile, it's appropriate to stay upright, present for what's difficult, without either giving into it, running away from it, or fixing it. This is a radically different way, I think, than how most people relate to what's difficult and their challenges and all this. And it opens up a different kind of door. And in terms of the teachings I gave earlier this week, this idea to cultivate and develop the capacity to be present for suffering and be wishless, to not be able to have a satisfying, empowered presence and have no wishes in relationship to that suffering, no desires for or against, brings the mind to a very still and peaceful place that, as I talked about earlier in the week, is the door to liberation, that really opens something up in the mind, in the heart, that there can be a profound release. And it's quite a revelation to discover that there can be a deep, deep letting go and release of something deep inside, where the problems of the world, our problems, you know, in the world, don't have to be solved in the conventional ways that people are often trying to solve them. But we can become really free in a very, very deep way through this door of discovering how to be, for a certain moment of time, not forever, to be have the mind so peaceful and still that there's a wishless, there's a desireless state of peace, of stillness, that lets things go. So as Vipassana practice deepens, it's important to understand that we're beginning to leave behind the problem-solving mind, the mind that's trying to understand and to penetrate into the cause of suffering. That's not necessary anymore as we go deeper and deeper. As we go deeper and begin having the strength of presence to be able to see and be mindful of experience, that opens up the door for us to look at suffering, at painfulness, as distress, discouragement, all kinds of things, in a clearer way. And sometimes to keep doing this thing about just looking and finding freedom that way is not really the right thing to do, the appropriate thing to do. Sometimes what's called on is to really go in and understand the conditions, the causes of what the suffering is. And that's many things we can study. Sometimes it's important to become aware of the social conditions around us that are contributing to suffering we're experiencing, other people are experiencing, the distress, the oppression, the difficulties we live in. And our ability to hold ourselves in this upright, clear, powerful way allows us to look and study what's going on in the world without succumbing to distress, without succumbing to discouragement, succumbing to anger, succumbing to giving up. All kinds of things that are not really that useful. Some of the kind of more unnecessary and maybe undermining ways in which we react to the terrible things that are happening in our world, it's useful to see them as undermining. It's giving in to sometimes to a feeling of hopelessness, helplessness. It's giving in to a feeling of hostility and blame, frustration. It's not. From a Buddhist practice point of view, you can actually feel how these stances and these approaches are not helpful. What's probably more helpful is to be able to hold your place, take your stance, and look directly and really see what's going on. There's this expression that comes out of, I think, Christianity about turning the other cheek. If someone hits you, I guess you're supposed to offer them the other cheek. There's no such idea in Buddhism. I'm not saying that's a bad teaching coming out of Christianity. It has a whole different context. In contrast, though, I wanted to say that in Buddhism, rather than giving someone the other cheek, we turn towards them and look them right in the eye and say, you can't do that, or stop. You really kind of confront what's there. And this ability to turn and look, that is what's important. Some of you might have seen in these stupas in Nepal and India, they have these big Buddha eyes. The ability to see the eye, to look, to be able to look deeply, is really kind of the hallmark of what Buddhism really wants to emphasize for us. And what allows us to look and look, so if the suffering's out there, we're studying in the world, to look from a place that doesn't undermine our ability to see clearly and bring forth what's best in us in relationship to it. But the same thing to look within ourselves. If there's a lot of challenges and suffering, and what is it inside ourselves that calls on us to look at it? What inside us wants our attention? What needs something from us? What is it inside of ourselves that needs to be loved and cared for and tended to when we have distress and despair and when life is painful for us? The ability, same thing, the ability to be still and to really look and observe and be present is such a wonderful, compassionate, kind, supportive thing to do. To ask ourselves, here I am struggling in my life. What is inside that needs my care and my attention? What needs to be held in the embrace of mindfulness and attention? Is it my fear? Is it the way I feel hurt? Is it my anger? Is it my loneliness? What is it that really could use attention? And here too, sometimes it's very powerful not to be in the fix-it mode, not to look and try to solve and fix anything, because the Dharma, this natural process of healing, resolution, and maturation, can often take care of many, many things if we hold our experience, if we make breathing room for what's going on, to make breathing room for our fear, our sadness, our anger, and but a lot of breathing room. Sometimes it needs a lot of time. And this ability to be still and to observe or be present for without being for or against, have the ability, that is a phenomenal gift. You know, as I sometimes like to say, in my years as a Buddhist teacher, one of the greatest sufferings, greatest challenges I've seen in people are people who, as a child, were not really seen by their parents. Not being seen is pretty much the same thing as not being loved. There's something about seeing, being seen and really seen for who you are and how you are, that is, as a child grows up, is such an important part of their development, such an important part of feeling like they belong and they're part of this world and they're worthy and they're cared for, that they're loved. There's something about mindfulness where we see ourselves, see what's difficult inside of ourselves, that it is a kind of love. If we can learn how to see without trying to push away or always be fixing, always doing it away with, but just to hold and be present in a kind, supportive way. So in many ways, the path of mindfulness is not a path of fixing. It's not even often necessarily the path of understanding the causes of our own suffering. It is a path of going in deeper to see what really needs attention here. Where do we need to hold our awareness? What do we have to hold openly and kindly? And just allow it to unfold and allow it to show itself. What inside do we need to listen to deeply? Listen to so deeply, listen so well, that we listen with a quiet mind. A mind that doesn't, you know, have all this chatter and ideas, and but just listens and listens. What's in here? A silent listening to the depth of who we are. We might, along the way, discover something that many Buddhists have discovered, and that is that one of the primary places, contributors to suffering, has to do with how we cling, grab, grasp, how we get attached to things. That also can be the same as how we push things away. And this learning about learning how the somatic experiences of clinging, of grasping, learning what it does to the eyes, and the eyes kind of get squinted sometimes, noticing what it does to the forehead, or the does it get bunched up or tight, or noticing what does in the brain. Sometimes clinging and attachment can be felt in the kind of between the temples, is a tightening, a constricting. Or in the chest, or the belly, or shoulders, all these different places somatically where clinging exists. Or how being attached and clinging and grasping is felt in the field of awareness. There's sometimes a feeling the mind, the attention, the scope of attention gets very narrow and gets kind of obscure and not really clear when there's a lot of clinging. Part of the value of this ability to really sense and feel and get to know experience, to see and be still and just keep looking and seeing, is that we get a really clear feeling for what clinging feels like in us. So we can recognize when it's there, we can recognize it when it's coming, and it can make a life a lot simpler if we recognize the clinging and relax, than if every time we cling to something, we think we have to analyze what we're clinging to and have an argument with it and discuss whether I should or shouldn't I be clinging. Is this important to hold on to? What's really going on here? And why am I clinging? And what happened yesterday that I'm clinging today? Those kinds of reflections are useful at times, but the simplicity of beginning to recognize whether the hand is held clenched or whether the hand is open. It's that kind of simple. And to learn to trust non-clinging, trust not resisting, trust not grasping on. And that in turn supports the ability to have clear, empowered mindfulness, a clear sense of really being empowered presence and attention to what is, so that wisdom can operate. So we know how to take care of ourselves. We know what we need to do and how to do it, hopefully without needing to cling to anything. It's possible without any clinging whatsoever to look someone in the eye and say, no, we're not going to do that. I'm not going to do that. Or it's possible to, without any clinging whatsoever, to have an upwelling of love and compassion and generosity, and to act with tremendous energy in a way that looks maybe passionate to other people, to be really go out and really support and help this world. We don't need to cling. We don't need to grasp on. In fact, the Buddha said, nothing whatsoever is worth clinging to. And to learn to have confidence about an empowered life without clinging is one of the great things to unfold and develop through this practice. And having some form of willingness to have well-being, discovering well-being, happiness, confidence, really has gives kind of part of this strength to non-clinging, strength to this empowered mindfulness that's possible for us. Relaxed, easeful, empowered mindfulness. So one of the themes this talk that I gave today is a point which maybe, I don't know how often you've heard this from a Buddhist teacher, and that is that it's not always necessary in a psychological way or in this personal way of Dharma practice within ourselves to always solve all the places of distress, all the painful things that go on. There are other ways. And sometimes always being on the road of trying to solve and fix and resolve and understand in some kind of psychological way, sometimes that's really important to do that. But if that's the only way we have, we're really missing a whole rich, valuable approach to coming to freedom. And that is not to solve anything, but to have the presence of mind, of mindfulness, that allows things to dissolve, that allows something powerful to evolve within us. And so sometimes it's a little bit like I said earlier, like a snake that gets big and strong and sheds its old skin. And I hope and I'm confident that each of you can, in fact, mature, evolve, develop. There are powerful forces, which I call Dharma forces, that are within us, that are capable of evolving and growing and maturing. We don't have to live a life of suffering, but allow yourself to become strong. Allow yourself to grow. Make room for this strength that you're capable of to grow and evolve and develop so that you have a taste and experience of awareness, which can be aware of anything at all, and at the same time be independent of what it's aware of. Independent meaning not entangled or caught with things. So, to have insight into what is painful in all the different ways that life presents itself that is painful, and to learn how to be free in the midst of this painful world. So thank you, and I hope it wasn't too painful to listen to that. And I'll see you again here at 7:30. Thank you. And for those of you on YouTube, I appreciate that you came, that you participated in this, and I appreciated that those of you who in your chat in different ways try to get the message across to me about the sound. And we're all finding our way, and sharing the Dharma is a fortunate thing, and I thank you for this chance, and I look forward to our continuing this theme and having this contact. So, best wishes. Oh, there's a question here, I see it. Will you be on YouTube in the morning? Yes, so tomorrow morning will be the last time, 7 a.m., for the series, this 10-part series that I'm doing this week. And we'll do it again tomorrow at 4 o'clock for the final Dharma talk. I think it's at 4. No, the Dharma talk tomorrow is at 2:30. So I better announce that tomorrow. So it's an earlier time tomorrow. If you want to come, I keep looking here because my screen is here. So if you want to come to the final talk, you'd have to do it at 2:30 California time tomorrow. Great. Thank you.